The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
On the 10th of April, the US President Donald Trump imposed a tariff of 145% on all Chinese imports. In response, China placed a 125% levy on US imports. This left trade between the world's two biggest economies almost impossible. Now, this weekend, senior U.S. officials are set to meet a high-level Chinese delegation for the first time since the start of Trump's trade war. And joining me to talk about all of this in more detail is Irish Times China correspondent Dennis Staunton, who's back on a quick visit to Ireland. Dennis, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Everyone expected Trump to do something, but when he imposed those draconian tariffs on China, what was the reaction in China?
I think they were shocked by just how severe they were. And I think that what was happening in the early days of the Trump presidency, before he started his tariff stuff, the Chinese had been trying to reach out through back channels to try to get some kind of talks going. And they got nowhere. They didn't find anyone to talk to. And so then suddenly he announces all of this. They reciprocate and then it escalates. So you, as you say, it's 145, 125. So I think that, you know, they then sort of thought to themselves, well, there's no point in caving. You've got to be tough. And so they got tough and then they sat back and allowed the markets to do some of the work for them.
Now, there is no way they would be seen to be backing down.
Yeah, I think, first of all, they don't think it's a good idea. But also, I think that they wouldn't want to be seen either domestically or among their neighbours to be backing
down. Touch.
Exactly, because they're basically, we're a big, powerful country and we're not going to get pushed around.
Now, the question of saving face, is that an element or is that just an old wives' tale?
No, it is an element, but it's also, in a way, another way of putting it is, if you think about the Communist Party's project historically, part of what it's been doing is as a national project to restore China, because China had this so-called century of humiliation, having been the great and one of the most powerful civilizations in the world. Then from the early 19th century onwards, you had Britain, the Opium Wars, all of the major European powers colonizing parts of China, chopping it up. And so then when the communists came into power in 1949, part of their project really was to restore China's
pride. So that still enlightens everything.
I think it does, yeah. And so part of also, like when Xi Jinping talks about China and about sort of the new era, he is talking about a project of national restoration, China restoring itself to its rightful place in the world.
Now, my idea of communism, born, of course, during the Cold War and all of that, and memories of Stalin and Lenin and all the rest, is of rather austere people who put, you know, the well-being of the masses subservient to their own well-being.
Well, it's kind of changed a bit in the so far as, I mean, it was never entirely, I suppose, without having some gradations, either in the Soviet Union or in China. In China, they were a little bit more so like that for a while. But then after the death of Mao in the late 1970s, you had this so-called reform and opening up. And really what China did was it embraced the methods of capitalism to make the place more prosperous, to lift people out of poverty. And so while they're still communists, there are 99 million members of the Chinese Communist Party, and they're still communists. They're communists it's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
We used to think of the capitalism versus communists. You can have communists who are capitalists, which...
Or you have a system, for example, which is basically a system where the state makes some big economic decisions, but it also creates an atmosphere of fierce competition. And competition among businesses in China is much fiercer than anything you've seen in Europe.
The response by China then, it did seem as if they had thought about this quite strategically. So they decide to send the Boeings back. The Boeings that were being delivered from Boeing in Seattle to China. No, we don't want them. We'll build our own or we'll find aircraft somewhere else. They decided we don't want your LNG. We'll go to Australia for that. We don't want your beef. Thank you very much. We'll go to Australia for that. And they are talking to their nearest neighbours and forming trading alliances with those. They must have had that plan. This is not something that arose overnight.
No, they've been talking about this and thinking about this since before the US election last year. They always expected that rather in, like in the first term, there would be some kind of trade war and that then there would be a negotiation and a deal at some stage. And so they were preparing for this. And really they took sort of three approaches. They thought, first of all, you need to get tough, hit back hard, so there's a cost to America for doing this. Then you reach out to other countries around the world. So like, for example, the Europeans, and you say, look, your friends in America have gone crazy. We, on the other hand, you may not like us in every way, but we're reliable, we're predictable trading partners. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is that they're trying to boost domestic demand at home. So you've got all these stimulus measures being rolled out almost every week.
What kind of stimulus measures? I mean, we know there was something of a housing crisis because of the cost of housing rather than the availability. Is that so?
There's basically been a huge housing crash for the last sort of number of years. It's basically, you know, the market has collapsed. They built too much. And then, and rather like here, I mean, the home ownership rate in China is over 90%. It's higher than it is in Ireland.
So they can afford housing.
So, oh yeah, absolutely, and that's where everybody puts their savings. They save a lot of money and they put it into housing. And so then, you know, once that crashed, it meant that nobody felt like spending any money. So that's had a huge impact. So one of the things that, like this week, for example, yesterday they had the latest round of monetary policy instruments. So that, for example, mortgage lending is cheaper, it's easier. So there's all of that kind of thing. But what they haven't really done to a huge extent yet is pump money in to give people money to spend directly. And that may be the next stage.
So they have to do it in such a way that they will not simply save it, they will spend it.
They need to make sure they spend it, exactly. Yeah.
Now, what is the living standard of a typical middle-income Chinese person? You're living in Beijing, so you know how it is.
So it kind of varies. It's certainly like if you look at it in terms of sort of, you know, euro or dollar terms, it's considerably lower than it would be here.
But what can it buy?
But what it can buy is quite a lot. So everything, like almost everything is very cheap. And so things like food, things like transport, things like clothing, all of those basic things are really very cheap. And then you have what you've had lately in the last few years is, say, almost everybody I know has renegotiated their rent downwards. And, you know, over the last few years, every year for the last few years. So, you know, and then what you also have is a kind of safety net because of the nature of the family there. People will, if things go bad, they'll go home and live with their families and they'll sit it out for a while and then they'll go back in and get stuck in again.
Speaking of the family, I mean, do you see 2, 3 and 4 child families now?
You see some, but not many.
Not many.
And so they're encouraging people to have as many children as possible, but people don't want to. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that it's expensive. Another is that women now feel more empowered and they don't really want to get married and have children right away. And then the third thing is that the pressure that kids are under, the educational system is so highly pressured that some parents just think, I don't really want to have a child and put them through all of that.
Can you characterize the relationship between Russia and China? Because they did pledge eternal friendship with each other.
Yeah, so they've had an up and down relationship over the decades. And at the moment, they've got a good relationship, but it's wary. So that they say that they've got a friendship without limits, but the limits are very clearly there.
And what is the nature of it? I mean, it's got to be symbiotic in some ways. So what do the Russians need from China and what do the Chinese want from Russia?
So the Russians, one thing the Russians provide to China is energy. China doesn't have its own energy. It doesn't really have much by way of oil, gas, coal or anything like
that. Which would explain why they've led the way on solar.
Yes, they're huge in renewables, but that's still not enough. They still burn coal. They still bring lots of oil in. And so they bring a lot of it from the Middle East. They bring some of it from Russia. What we're expecting this week is that they may have this, they may agree a deal on a new natural gas pipeline. Now the Europeans have said they're never buying any natural gas from Russia again, that they will be selling more into China. What Russia gets from China is, especially since the war in Ukraine began, kind of everything that they buy. So according to people who, in Russia, you go into the shops, everything is Chinese. All the cars are Chinese. Everything that was Western European is now Chinese. And the Russians are a bit alarmed by the speed with which the Chinese were able to take over this market. And then what they each offer each other is support in a world which is hostile to them, where so that basically they're saying that, you know, this Western alliance and the United States, you can't throw your weight around because we are going to stand up for each other.
Where does China really stand on Ukraine? Do they just let Russia at it and give them whatever help? They've said they're not giving them weapons, whatever about Chinese, whether they're ex-prisoners or what, are being sent to the front line, but they're there.
So they've got a slightly complicated view of it. So China is very keen on not violating borders. And so so they've never, for example, recognized Crimea as being part of Russia. And so they don't. So they're quite strict on that. On the other hand, they do accept the Russian narrative of the root causes of the war. They do believe that NATO expansion was an aggressive act towards Russia. They have this idea of indivisible security, so that, in other words, you can't bolster your own security at the expense of my security. And so they, so ideologically and diplomatically, they're in support of Russia, but they also have always had very good relations with Ukraine, and they're a big trading partner with Ukraine in terms of, say, buying wheat and various other things.
So will they have any role to play in a forthcoming peace?
They would like to, and I think they could have. At the moment, the only peace negotiation going on, and it's not really going on, is the American one with Steve Witkoff. But you know, if something were to happen, then I think they could play a role.
Now, looking at some economic commentary about what China produces that America needs and consumes, and Trump has dropped some of the tariffs on mobile phones and bits and pieces. He's playing around at the margins of all of this. But the economic commentary said that there's no way that America can ever produce the amount of stuff that America consumes within its own borders. They simply do not have the people, which China has.
Yeah, so China doesn't. Not only does it have the people, it increasingly now has the robots. And if you go into a Chinese factory now, increasingly you see very few people. It's all entirely automated. But also what China has, it has the skills, it has the supply chains, it has the resources. It has built up this incredibly efficient system of manufacturing, which is why it's so difficult to compete with them.
So the Americans will never, well, not without two decades of effort, be able to replicate that, and they don't have the people. The people who might do those jobs are being exported, deported to...
Exactly. So you have, say, so in a way there are kind of two categories of stuff that China exports to America. One is this, these high-end things you were talking about, like smartphones and laptops and everything else. And most of the laptops and smartphones that come into America come from China. And then you have all those cheap things, you know, toys, Christmas trees, you know, all of that stuff, which, you know, T-shirts, shoes, all of that, which you just simply, you know, the US couldn't suddenly just create this.
Now, the whole idea is who blinks first. America has yet really to suffer the inflationary effects of tariffs, but it's coming and the shelves will be empty, it appears, by the empty cargo ships that are coming into Seattle without their Chinese, their typical Chinese cargoes. So time will tell fairly soon how the Americans will react. What about China? How are they suffering because of the American action?
China's starting to feel it right now. So for the first few months of this year, manufacturing output was up and exports as well, because people were sort of front-loading stuff, getting rid of it as soon as possible. What's now happened is that you talk to exporters and they will tell you that even if the Americans have already paid for stuff, they're saying don't ship it, because if you ship it now, it's subject to 145%. Maybe next month it's going to be 25%.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so who knows? So everything has just stopped. And that is affecting the Chinese.
Mm. Now, what do you make of these prospective talks in Switzerland?
I think what the general expectation seems to be is that the best you can hope for immediately would be some kind of de-escalation. Now, what that could mean is the two sides meet and they say, we value our relationship and we've decided that we've had constructive talks and we want to go forward. That would be sort of at the low end, but still it'd be kind of okay. What a better option than that might be that they say, okay, we're now reducing from 145 and 25, we'd go all the way down to 25 or something like that temporarily, and we're going to keep it this way while we're talking. Nobody's expecting a kind of a breakthrough or a deal. But what I think it is true to say that both sides actually want a deal. They can't trade with each other right now. Yeah. They need to trade with each other. And so they both would like to have some kind of
deal. And do you believe in Trump's ideology on tariffs, that he believes so fervently in them, irrespective of the evidence that's produced to the contrary?
He appears to have believed in them for a very long time. And so I'm the other, you know, so I suppose he does. I mean, who knows? Hard to see inside his head. The other problem that they have is that the Americans would like to have talks between Xi and Trump right away. The Chinese say that comes at the very end. You've actually done the deal by the time those two meet, and they're not going to put him in the Oval Office with Trump like Zelensky.
Or indeed, Mark Carney, why they put up with the circus, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, with an audience of thousands in the Oval Office. Dennis, I enjoy your pieces very much, writing from China, and thank you very much for coming into studio to talk with us today. Now,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.